let's come to one of the surprising issues that emerges out of the United States is the tremendous springboard of women. And in Hermetic America, some of the most extraordinary figures in Hermetic America are women. And we talked a little bit about one of the earliest of those women, Margaret Fuller, who was born in 1810. She was born right around the time that Abraham Lincoln was born. And had she not have died when she was just really coming into her maturity, she drowned in 1850, so she was not quite 40 years old. Margaret Fuller, who became an extraordinary figure, became the editor of the Transcendentalist famous magazine, The Dial, with Ralph Waldo Emerson. And this was in 1840, when she was just 30 years old. A co-editor with Emerson and Margaret Fuller was Thoreau. So that you had this very compact group. And they were not just wanting to make a magazine, but they wanted to make a focused platform within which a new transform could take place. The key to it was the expansion of a primordial sense, not of Christianity, but of Jesus. And a great deal of the pressure to do this came from the young Emerson, who, as we talked about, had become the pastor of the Second Church in Boston, one of the Boston Brahmin great facilities, and after 6 years had left, had resigned, had literally said, I can no longer preach in a church. And he began then giving presentations, lectures, to a general public to encourage them that there was more happening than could happen in institutions. And he never again would join institutions. And one of his earliest addresses was on American civilization. And as a follow-up to that, he gave an address to the Harvard Divinity School encouraging them to understand that all of the institutional history of a Christianity, of a Christianism, was something that belonged to the old world. But it belonged to the old world, not to the ancient world, not to the primordial world, and that the new world of the United States, the new American world, was an ancient primordial world coming back into play again. And that the key fulcrum of the change from the old to the primordial, which is also the new, was self-reliance. That one had to come to a realization that who you were was not defined by previous doctrines, by previous dogmas, that the outline of your possibilities was not drawn by the institutions and their reach into your life into your character, into your person, and that it was incumbent on all in the new world to recover the primordiality of their own being, their own spirit. Margaret Fuller, in writing to this point, deepened it and underscored that women were especially victims of the circumscribing of what they were, of what they could do, and she wrote this way. I have no doubt, however, that a large proportion of women would give themselves to the same employments as now, motherhood, marriage, being home makers, because there are circumstances that must lead them. Mothers will delight to make the nest soft and warm. Nature will take care of that. No need to clip the wings of any bird who wants to soar and sing, or finds in itself the strength of pinion for a migratory flight unusual to its kind. The differences would be that all need not be of this kind, that all not be constrained to employments for which some are unfit. And we will see in today's presentation that while this was being delivered in 1840, by the time of one lifetime later, a great Hermetic American woman, Amy Lowell, would exemplify the freedom of the New World future primordial ancient woman in her own lifetime. Margaret Fuller, though, is the beginning, the place where we throw the pebble into the pond. And when we come to Amy Lowell, we'll see that the ripples show that it is an infinite pond. I have urged upon the sex self-subsistence in its two forms of self-reliance and self-impulse, because I believe that them to be needed by means of the present juncture. I have urged on women independence of man. Not that I think the sexes mutually needed by one another, but because in women, this fact has led to an excessive devotion which has cooled love, degraded marriage, and prevented either sex from being what it should be to itself or to the other. I wish women to live first for God's sake, then she will not make an imperfect man her God, and thus sink to idolatry. This is tough language in 1840. That she will not take what is not fit for her from a sense of weakness and poverty. Then if she finds what she needs in man embodied, she will know how to love and to be worthy of being loved. By being more a soul, she will not be less woman, for nature is perfected through spirit. So that you have this incredible push in Concord, Massachusetts, just outside of Boston, within 14 years of the death of Thomas Jefferson, within a short generation from the death of Benjamin Franklin, who died just 50 years before, so that you have a burgeoning explosiveness that from here on into the 21st century accelerates itself in two ways. It accelerates itself by an expansion, that for sure, but it also accelerates itself by a concentration, and that the concentration becomes more and more poignant, and the expansion becomes more and more cosmic. And the poignancy is on the ability to transform more and more of what is existential, of what is mental, into possibilities that were not there before. And the correct ancient primordial practice of this is aptly named alchemy. The ancient name for Egypt from its own self was not Egypt, but Chem. Alchemy is the ancient Egyptian way of understanding proportionality as a ratioing of a divine which has many aspects, and it is the ratioing of those various aspects in ever new combinations of proportions that gives an insight into how one can be a part of the living cosmos. And that the detail of the living cosmos is that it occurs fresh every day, and each day is prepared by an equal night, and that that night will have 12 gates through which then the sun will rise on the day, and there will be 12 hours for that day. And at sunset, the entry into the night is the entry into a nether world, which at the same time is a cosmic world, and that it is the plane of the earth in the day that is like a diameter of this great huge sphere, that the lower part is a nether world, the upper part is an overworld, and that they together are a beyond each world, which is eternal. And that as the course of each day, for while the sun has risen and before it sets, in that concourse as it goes over the dome of the sky, it illumines the diameter of the day of the world, and it is fresh every day. And if the preparation has been right, if one has emerged from the gates of the night, from the netherworld, one will participate in the day with an overworld expansive view. One will have a divine visionary understanding of what this day is doing in eternity. And having done that and completed the yoga of that day in that way, one is better prepared than for that coming night to go with an ever more rhythmic motion through the 12 gates of the night and to rise with the sun of the next day, renewed and freshened, and the vision occurring not just again, but occurring for the first time again. That there is a primordiality at all of the steps, all of the stages. One has not built up an itinerary. One has not cemented an agenda. One is in an ongoing dynamis, of which it looks like a pilgrimage to those who are outside, but to you who are inside, it is a practice of the, as Plato said, time is the moving image of eternity. So that temporality is an image. The existence of things and actions in their effective sets, the rituals, are images of appearances and not the reality. The reality is not that there are archetypal things. That is really juvenile. It is that the archetypal eternity is all things and exactly this thing in a deep complementarity, so that one can look more and more at the actuality of something. And we saw the ability already in Jonathan Edwards, who died from a smallpox inoculation in 1758, just as he was entering as the president of Princeton, one of the earliest presidents of, it was called Princetown at that time, Princeton. He had been a minister. He had been one of the most famous American ministers that we have delivered, and he was locked out of his church, very much like the play Night of the Iguana by Tennessee Williams, about the Reverend Shannon being locked out of his church for having a sexual encounter with a young woman in the congregation. Edwards was locked out and sent to the lowest rung on the ladder. He was sent to Stockbridge, Massachusetts, to be a tutor for the Indians. The Indians who were being pacified, they were being taken out of the wilderness and put into a dogmatic conditioning so that they could be manageable, and they would be manageable on the lowest rung. And in a way, it was converting the freedom of primordiality, mischaracterized as the savagery and a wilderness, that barbarism should be tamed. And it is the false taming of persons by institutions, by dogmas, that reaches the demonic level when they themselves are their own wardens. They imprison themselves so that they are looked upon as participating in the status quo, in the norm. And anyone who tries to be outside of the shape, outside of the configuration, is seized upon as being unruly, as being suspect, and finally, probably, as being demonic. All of this comes to a head when the editors of the Dial, the readers of the Dial, there were not many, there were maybe 200 or 300 at the time, but they decided that they needed to put it into practice, and so they opened up a utopian community called Brook Farm. And the membership of Brook Farm reads like a who's who of early New England genius, running all the way from Emerson and Fuller and Thoreau to Nathaniel Hawthorne, et cetera. It's an enormous undertaking. One of the figures who was prominent in that, as we have talked about, was Bronson Alcott, who was a little bit older. Emerson was born in 1803, Alcott born in 1800. So Alcott was born with the inauguration, the first election of Thomas Jefferson, and he lived to be 88. And soon was not only running a wisdom school in one of the temples in Boston, so it was called the Temple School, but began then to set up another kind of utopian community called Fruitlands, and then to spearhead opening up the Concord School of Philosophy, which ran for many years and included finally individuals like William James lecturing there. But Alcott put into practice the raising of his children in this new primordial, this new ancient and future modern way. And the most famous of his children was Louisa May Alcott. Now, we all know Louisa May Alcott and her fabulous bestseller, Little Women. There have been 4 film versions of it. This is the latest one with Susan Sarandon and Winona Ryder. We all think of Louisa May Alcott as this nice little children's young adult writer, and it was a big shock to people when behind a mask, The Unknown Thrillers of Louisa May Alcott was released, and then another half dozen, A Marble Woman, Unknown Thrillers of Louisa May Alcott, and it turned out that under a pseudonym, she wrote some of the raciest, supernatural, thriller detective story, eerie, violent, sexy tales of the age. And a description from an early biography of Louisa May Alcott. She also died in 1888, and this was published in Boston, 1890. Just a few sentences at the end, the conclusion. Miss Alcott's appearance was striking and impressive rather than beautiful. Her figure was tall and well-proportioned, indicating strength and activity. And she walked with freedom and majesty. She had a gait, and she was her own person. Her head was large, and her rich brown hair was long and luxuriant, giving a sense of fullness and richness of life to her massive features. She was not a little girl. She was formidable. She was a lioness. While thoroughly unconventional and even free and easy in her manner, she had a dignity of deportment which prevented undue liberties and made intruders stand in awe of her. Generous in the extreme and serving others, she knew her own rights and did not allow them to be trampled on. She repelled the spurns that patient merit of the unworthy takes, and had much of the burned spirit that sings, a man's a man for all that, in the presence of insolent grandeur. This was published in 1890, and at the time, a young girl of one of the most famous of all the Boston Brahmin families was already able to read and write, and her name is Amy Lowell. The Lowell family, for maybe five, six generations, had been one of the pioneering families in setting up very large industrial businesses. They founded, for instance, Lowell, Massachusetts. Amy's great-great-grandfather went to England when the first mills were being set up there in the beginning of the Industrial Revolution to weave fabric by machines. And he memorized the designs of these, came back to Boston, and set up a family business that just extended itself and made so much money that he went into real estate and many other kinds of businesses, and all of the Lowells became fabulously wealthy. But of all the Lowells, the greatest was the first Lowell woman to come upon the scene like a lioness, and that was Amy Lowell. She was not quite ill, but at the end of her life, and she was born in 1874, in 1925, this is from the Lowells of and their Seven Worlds. The Seven Worlds is a hermetic ascription. The biggest confines of mankind were the seven spheres of the sun, the moon, and the five planets. The Greek word for that was the Hymarmene, and it meant that it wasn't just the strength of human institutions. It wasn't just the strength of human rituals or of the inculcation of human institutions, but that there was a confining done by the moving bodies of the star system on the earth, and that those seven worlds were the onion of fate. They were the way in which destiny confines and constrains not just you, but all of us permanently as long as we are here. She was to sail on the ship Ben-Gurion to go out into the world as one of the most famous writers of her time. And she was to sail April 26th, but on the 9th, a complimentary dinner in honor of Miss Amy Lowell was given in the ballroom of the Hotel Somerset in Boston. Some hundreds of distinguished persons were, on the whole, rather pleased when the guest of honor arrived an hour late, a true grand dame of the Boston Brahmins, and distinctly gratified when, with the coffee, she produced her capacious cigar case. So she would light up her stogies and have her coffee on a par with any man in the place. She had a pedigree that outstripped anyone in the place, and she herself had established herself as herself. There were laudatory speeches covering every phase of her work by men and women who knew what they were talking about. Glenn Frank, editor of The Century magazine, speaking out of turn to catch the midnight train for New York, nominated her for president of the United States. Amy arose saying that the speeches of the evening were such that she hadn't recognized herself, but she hoped her cat Winky would when she got home, and then read a couple of poems to them. What she was saying is, you cannot constrain me by compliments, by laudatory. I am outside and have lived outside of all of those constraints. And later, on the morning of the 12th, she woke up and said to Mrs. Russell, "Peter, I am done. Why can't they leave me alone?" Later in the day, she suddenly found her hand numb. And looking in a mirror, she saw the right side of her face drop. "Pete," she said, "a stroke." She became unconscious immediately and died in an hour and a half later. To those who had worked with her, it was as if a force of nature had been turned off. One of her last poem collections is about a quality of eternity in the moving image of the self-reliant spirit of the person, man or woman, in her case, a woman. And the volume published in Boston by Houghton Mifflin, 1925, it's called What's O'Clock? What time is it in the universe? This poem, as a sample, is called Once Jericho. And it's about Jericho because Jericho was recognized by that time as being one of the earliest human communities on the planet, where farming was introduced for the very first time. That instead of being hunter-gatherers, man had achieved, men and women had achieved, the ability to shift from hunting and gathering to farming and to animal husbandry. The men largely tended the animals, but the women largely tended the plants. So that early farming, the taming of the plants, so that one had a continuous, dependable food supply, is a feminine contribution to civilization. And Jericho then becomes a symbol of that feminine contribution from eternity, dwarfing the institutional misunderstanding of things. And in the poem, one finds it reading this way: walking in the woods one day, I came across a great river of rye sweeping up between tall pine trees. The gray, green heads of the rye jostled and flaunted and filled all the passage with a tossing of bright bearded ears. It was very fine, marching and bending under the smooth, wide undulation of the upper branches of pine. Yee, yee, cried the little cinquefoil. What is this bearded army which marches upon us? The cinquefoil is a little flower, five-petaled. And the loose strife called out that somebody was treading on its toes, but the rye never heeded. Bread, bread, it shouted, and wagged its golden beards. Bread conquering the forest. I stood with the little cinquefoil, crushed back against a bush of sheep's laurel. I am sorry if I crowd you, said I, but the rye is marching, and the grass and yellow banners blind me. Also, the clamor of the great triumphants is confusing. But you are trampling me down, wailed the loose strife. Alas, even so, yet do not blame me, for I too scarcely have room to stand. Then a gust of wind ran upon the tall rye, and it flung up its glittering helmets and shouted, bread, again and again. And the hubbub of it rolled superbly under the balancing pines. Three times the trumpets, thought I. And I picked up the cinquefoil. Why not on my writing table, I said, caressing its petals with my finger. And that, I take it, is the end of the story. One of the qualities of Amy Lowell was that she is the first American writer to write haiku, because immediately after that poem in What's O'Clock, what time do you think it is in eternity? Our 24 haiku, they called them hoku at the time because that was the pronunciation that came in, 24 hoku on a modern theme. A sample. Again, the larkspur, heavenly blue in my garden, they at least unchanged. So much is kaleidoscopic, yet in that kaleidoscope of an almost infinite variety is the exactness of the moment of what is real in itself, including oneself, which will now, the next moment, be just as real and possibly different, or possibly unchanged in its exactness in the Zen moment. Another, have I hurt you? Yet look at me with pale eyes. But these are my tears. Amy Lowell's older brother became one of the most famous astronomers of all time, Percival Lowell. And he's the one who started the entire realization that Mars must be inhabited by intelligent beings. And in 1895, in the Atlantic Monthly magazine, published in Boston by Houghton Mifflin, from May, June, July, and August of 1895, these are old volumes of the collected Atlantic Monthly, he presented four essays in 4 months about Mars, about its need to be looked at as an intelligently ancient inhabited place. And when we come back from the break, we'll see what an enormous explosion this produced, including the founding of the great 24-inch telescope observatory in Flagstaff, Arizona, the Lowell Observatory, devoted to trying to understand Mars and its canals and its water system and the change that was coming to human beings by realizing there are more intelligent beings than them, even as close as the nearest planet to us. What else must be out there in the cosmos? One of the qualities that is peculiar is that it wasn't until he was a very mature man, was born in 1874, that he even began to think in these terms, not 1874, 1854. He was 19 years older than Amy, 1854. So when he brought this out in 1895, he was in his early 40s, 41, 42. He was one of the most strikingly handsome, disciplined men that anyone had ever seen, wealthy beyond belief, a great master of financial investments, and made piles of money. But what got him was the need to get out of the institutions, to get out of the family preferences, to get out of the false labeling of him. And so he decided with a friend of his to go traveling, especially to the Far East, and he went to Japan. And in Japan, he immediately set about learning Japanese almost in record time and became so proficient and so respected that when the new established independent country of Korea, centered with the capital in Seoul, wanted to open up as an independent country a trade relationship with the United States, they contracted Percival Lowell to be their ambassador to the United States to make these deals, which he did greatly to the advantage of the new Korea, and then spent another 10 years in Japan, where he became the author of a whole new way in which Japan looked upon the West, and part of the development of Japan, being able by 1905 to defeat Russia in a war, was due to the uncanny confidence that the ways in which Percival Lowell had shown them, this is how you build power, this is how you use industry, this is how you arrange management so that you can finally have a management of an entire country in an industrial yoga. At that point, he was reminded that there's something even larger to organize and that astronomy needed to investigate the stars. And he devoted the rest of his life coming back to the United States to do just that, starting with Mars. Let's take a break. Let's come back and realize for ourselves that there are two dynamics involved. And when you put them together, they form a complementarity like the double helix of DNA. But what carries the double helix of the DNA is the single helix of RNA, of which there are several major versions. The RNA as a single helix is the archetypal symbol of medicine. Whenever you see a medical building or a medical traditional publication with its symbol, it is always the staff with the serpent spiraled around it. This is the staff of Asclepius. That staff of Asclepius is a branch of a cypress tree, which has been cut in such a way that there are the little branches that are roughly cut off so that there are little nubs of it. And Asclepius, as the bearded god of medicine, the archetypal physician, leans on holding this staff of cut cypress with the serpent coming from below the ground, from the netherworld, spiraling up in an energy frequency wave form, the serpent as a living creature whose movement is literally the sine wave motion of energy in dynamic. And we recognize that there is a deep relationship between the staff and the snake. And in order to go back specifically, one has to not use the word staff, but use the word rod. And in doing so, we immediately recognize the deep complementarity that is there between the snake and the rod, because this is the symbol by which God sends Moses back to Egypt to bring the covenanted people out. That he will take this staff and be able to throw it down onto the ground, and it will become a snake, it will become a serpent. The original Asclepius was a man who lived in Moses' time, who understood, like Moses did, that there is something hidden in the power of symbols that is not hidden in the symbols, but hidden in the user of the symbols. That someone who knows how to use symbols literally can do magic. The symbols will integrate a natural order, a natural cycle, a natural phase form. The symbols will be able to hold a geometry and an arithmetic together into its integral, but a magic from the ancient order of the Magi and the first recorded Magi order is about 2000 BC in what is today Central Asia, was the northern Iranian peoples living where Samarkand classically was located, on the Amu Darya, on the Oxus rivers, which did not flow into the southern swath of civilizations, from India to Britain to Ireland is a whole swath of civilizations. But in Central Asia, those rivers flow to the east. They flow towards the Gobi Desert. They flow towards China. They flow towards Japan. So that the Central Asian is really Central Asia as one of the centers of a whole swath of civilizations different from Ireland to India. This goes from the northern Caspian Sea all the way to Japan. And 2000 BC is the time in which you find Zarathustra. And Zarathustra, I spent 10 years making a deep poetic translation with a distinguished Iranian friend of mine, Mrs. Germani. And I know whereof I speak. The similarity of ancient Zarathustran wisdom with the primordial Chinese wisdom is striking. It's like the great similarity of many aspects in India with aspects in Britain and Ireland. One of the great writers on Celtic occult wisdom revealed was the Hermetic American E.Y. Evans Wentz, whose first great book was on the fairy faith of Celtic countries, a bestseller still in print, but found that in the Celtic Irish mythologies, the mythologies not only of Ireland, but of southern Scotland, of ancient Britain, not of England, but of Britain there before there was an England, not Angles and Saxons, but the archaic Celts who were there, that their cosmology, their mythic images are remarkably similar to those in northern India and Tibet. And so he went to Tibet, and his next book was the Tibetan Book of the Dead from the fairy faith in Celtic countries, and then wrote three more, so that there are four classic books published by Oxford University Press by E.Y. Evans Wentz, revealing the secrets of the Great Liberation, and that the great figure in that, the pivotal figure in that, was Milarepa. And Milarepa's place where he had his ashram was Mount Everest. So that Milarepa is really a cosmic yogi, that he chooses as the place where he will do his ashram training of people, he will do it here on Mount Everest. That scale of a man. And in order to deliver his teaching, Milarepa wrote thousands and thousands of poems, songs, the songs of Milarepa. But also understood what to someone on the outside is occult, but to someone who has practiced it all their lives, plural, it is the way in which eternity gives a vibratory presence to time, which brings into emergence all of the dimensions of space, which then give shape and give form. So that time is the first dimension of not space-time so much. It is space-time from the outside, but from the inside is time-space. But being on the inside of it is being on the inside before it moves as time, and that is pure consciousness. So that from the quintessential five dimensions of conscious time, space, the way in which forms emerge is instantly real as they actually are, and that they keep emerging real, but so quickly that it seems as if they maintain themselves and are then substantial. The Greek term for that is ousia. But the allness of the incredible vibrational rapidity is not called substance, but is called spirit. pneuma. It is the Spirit, eternal, that gives the context in which the vibration of energy achieves a dynamis in time and achieves an energy form in space, so that one can finally say, not in arithmetic, you could never say it in arithmetic, not in a mythology, you could never image it in a mythology, but you can express it exactly in an equation, E equals mc squared. Because the carrier, there always is a carrier. The carrier from eternity into time that blossoms as space and thus form, energy equals mass times the speed of light squared. It is the speed of light in space then that is the carrier. And what one says, light, the photon particle, carries the scalar of electromagnetic energy. But it carries it discretely. It doesn't carry it as if it were all. It carries it as the all occurring instantly, billions of times per time unit. And so one has a continuity. But the continuity is not that it is statically substantive, is existentially there. It is just remarkably accurately there, minutely in a difference, because in every atom, every atomic structure, there's no way to tell where the there is of an electron. Wherever it was there, you can count on the next trillion vibrations being different from where there was. But they will be approximately, and the only way that one can image it, give it a metaphorical word, is that its orbit will be at a certain energy level. It will be exactly 0.511 electron volts. Always. Every electron will have then its orbitals, and when an atomic structure fills out, it doesn't fill out arithmetically, it fills out in a paired balance. So that when you get enough electrons to fill a shell, the next shell will be at a different orbital distance, and you will have 8. And then when you fill up the 8 and its pair of 8s, the next will be a 16. And you will have pairs of 16, the next will be 32. It is the hermetic essence of understanding reality that is difficult for someone outside of it, because they cannot imagine it, because it's not imaginable. But it is able to be put into a poetic image if one can hear the poetry. We were talking this morning about the great women of Hermetic America, beginning with Margaret Fuller, going to Louisa May Alcott, jumping to Amy Lowell. Here's one of the last poems of Amy Lowell. She died at 49, suddenly. She died standing up, looking in a mirror, and saw the right side of her face sag and knew it was a stroke, and said to her companion — her companions all her life were women — she said to her companion, "A stroke." And she immediately fell unconscious and died about an hour and a half later. One of her last poems — she had just finished a big 2-volume poetic biography of the great poet Keats, John Keats. It will stand for all time as one of the most poetic biographies of anyone of all time. This is On Reading a Line, underscored by Keats, in a copy of Palmerin of England, another biography that she was reading at the time, and she writes the poem this way, one of her last poems. You marked it with a light pencil upon a printed page, and as though your finger pointed along a sunny path for my eyes' better direction, I see a knight mounted on a mulberry courser and attired in green armor. I think the sky is faintly blue, but with a spring shining about it, and the new grass scarcely fetlock high in the meads. He rides, I believe, alongside an overflow river, by a path soft and easy to his charger's feet. My vision confuses you with the green armored knight. So dight and comparisoned might you be in a land of faery. Thus, with denoting finger, you make of yourself an escutcheon to guide me to that in you which is its essence. But for the rest, the part which most persists and remembered, I only know I compass it in loving, and neither have nor need a symbol. Archetypal woman's wisdom. This quality became expanded because her family, as I pointed out, had long been associated not only with the Industrial Revolution in Europe, they were the first to set up mechanical industrial cloth mills in Lowell, Massachusetts, became fabulously wealthy. All of the Lowells then became famous, and all of them were men until Amy Lowell became the most famous of all the Lowells. And when she smoked her cigars and drank her black coffee with the men, they knew that she was a better man than they were. Her brother Percival, who became one of the great astronomers, and we'll get to the echo of what happened with Percival Lowell's Mars in just a moment, and find that at the far end of that is one of the great Hermetic American women, one of the greatest science fiction writers of all time, Leigh Brackett. But with Amy Lowell, with her brother Percival having been involved with Japan, having been selected by the new country of Korea to be the first ambassador from Korea to the United States, choosing an American to do that, set up a whole new relationship between Korea and the West, and then his 10 years of living in Japan set up a whole new relationship of Japan with the West. For Amy Lowell, not only being able to write haiku, and we read a couple of her haiku before the break. Here's another one. Morning and evening, yet for us once, long ago, was no division. She joined a lady friend of hers who took the pen name Florence Asco, and in 1921 published in Boston, Houghton Mifflin again. Houghton Mifflin are the publishers of Tolkien in America. They've been there from the beginning. Ticknor and Fields became Houghton Mifflin, and Houghton Mifflin has been one of the archetypal Hermetic America publishers for the last 150 years. She published in 1921 with Florence Asco, Fir Flower Tablets, Poems Translated from the Chinese. One of the most impressive collections of Chinese poetry translations ever done, still to this day. Now, I know how difficult it is to translate in this way from another language, having spent 10 years translating Zarathustra, who did not write in Farsi. He wrote in ancient Avestic. And one of the qualities of ancient Avestic is that it is a primordial Indo-European language, and that through the refinement of 1,300 years, English has transformed and refined itself enough that by the early 21st century, English was refined enough to be able for me to get back to the primordiality of the Indo-European language and to understand the Avestic eye to eye. And I did the same with Chinese, not being able to read Chinese per se, but being able to see eye to eye with someone expressing high dharma in Chinese and expressing it in English, modern poetic. This is one of Amy Lowell's translations of one of the greatest poets of all time, and the Chinese consider him, along with his friend Tu Fu, to be the two greatest poets in their entire heritage. And he certainly, with Tu Fu, are among the 10 best poets of all time on the planet. This is an answer to an affectionate invitation from Cui 15. Amy Lowell writing as if she were Li Po, who wrote the poem in Chinese, and now she's writing it in high dharma English poesis, so that Li Po's spirit, through her spirit empathy, can speak in English originally. It's not a translation. She says in the beginning, she says in the preface, because she was very direct. This is cigar-smoking Boston Brahmin genius. Let me state at the outset that I know no Chinese. My duty in Mrs. Askew's and my joint collaboration has been to turn her literal translations into poems as near to the spirit of the originals as it was in my power to do. Now, when I translated the Tao Te Ching, I used the best character for word original expression, the Chinese characters into English words, and the person that I used was D.T. Suzuki, the great Zen master. Because when he was 21 and his Zen master was quite insistent that D.T. Suzuki at 21 accept an invitation from Paul Karras in Chicago, Illinois, to go there and help him translate Asian classics, spiritual classics, the Chinese, the Japanese, etc. And the young D.T. Suzuki was a genius, even at 21, but he hadn't had his satori, his moment of enlightenment. And so Shoyin Shaku Roshi said, you may not go to the United States if you do not have your satori, your moment of enlightenment. And you must understand here, the first moment of enlightenment is not a moment, but is the phrase Aldous Huxley once used, it's the breath of eternity. It is not a moment in time. It is a space in time where the eternal discloses its real. And D.T. Suzuki was told by his Zen master, Shoyin Shaku Roshi, not only can you not go to the United States, but you must commit harikiri. You must kill yourself. And you have just a few days. And if you do not, then you must take your life. And the young D.T. Suzuki thinking about it, worrying about it, could not do it. And at the last moment of the last day, he said, later, he lived to be 97, he said, I walked out of the Zendo, and all the trees were transparent. All the buildings were transparent, and I looked down, and I was transparent too. Here is Li Po, Amy Lowell, using Florence Askew's Chinese character for words, and then Amy Lowell redoing the language so that the words were transformed by her visionary differential consciousness. And she pulled out of a mythic language of images held together by symbols into a transform infinity where they were free to be suspended. Heaven suspends its emblem, says the I Ching. And then reassembled as a jewel, not as a mental structure, not as a mental order, not as an arithmetical geometricity, but as a play dynamis jewel form. Li Po, Amy Lowell. You have the bird's footprint characters. You suggest that we drink together at the lute stream. The characters you wrote are in the center of a foot of pure white silk. They are like exquisite clouds dropped from heaven. Having finished reading, I smile into the empty air. I feel as though my friend were before me. Reciting verses for a long time. The characters are not faded. I shall keep them in my sleeve, and they shall last 3 years. It is a deep quality that appealed to the spirit of Hermetic America by this time. One of the figures that we're looking at today was her brother Percival Lowell, who, as we said, was a financial genius. He ran the family's industrial center in Lowell, Massachusetts for about 6 years, and then decided that he, as we said earlier today, he had to get outside of the fault-defining institutions, out of the falsifying, preemptive defining of the family, out of the strictures on him as a man who had to be a man in these ways which are socially acceptable, and he refused. He not only refused, he had the brilliance, he had the money, he had the courage, not only to step outside the lines, but to step off the paper on which lines are drawn. And so he reconfigured himself by learning the Japanese language, which is not an Indo-European language, in record time, and became able to write not only beautiful Japanese, but esoteric Japanese. He published 4 books. The first was published in 1885. It was called Chosen. We choose ourselves to be real at any given hiatus in the moments of assigned time. They do not choose us to be us. We are us when we are. Gurdjieff's famous phrase, I am only real then when I am. His second book was called The Soul of the Far East, published in 1888. the same year that Bronson Alcott died, that Amy Louisa May Alcott died. And the Soul of the Far East was enormously successful. But his last book, he wrote a third book called Noto, about his travel tale in 1891. But his final book in 1894 was Occult Japan. And for Occult Japan, he went into the most esoteric of the Buddhist trance states. And he wanted to disclose to people that these deep trance states were not metaphysical. A metaphysical is a projection of a mentality structure. They have nothing to do with metaphysics. If you want to use a term, you have to use a term that William James brought into play in a special way. It is a paraphysics. It's a parapsychology. Para in ancient Sanskrit, Indo-European language means beyond. A jhana is a way. A mahayana is the great way. A parayana is the real beyond, which is distilled from the mahayana. And the Japanese, like Japanese always do, they will take something and simplify it and refine it and simplify it and refine it until it is white stones raked every morning to be ripples, and that's the meditative pond, with maybe a rock or two so that the raked sand will ripple around that form in that raked white, and you don't have to read anything about the Mahayana to get the Zen of the Parayana. And as soon as Percival Lowell was at that level, a friend of his said, "It's time for you to leave Japan for the star system." Do you remember how when you were a boy, you were looking through your little 2.5-inch telescope? Well, here's an article from Italy from a man named Schiaparelli, who says that he thinks that through his telescope, he saw canals on Mars. And so Percival Lowell decided, "I am not going to go back to Massachusetts, to Boston. I'm not even going back to Earth. I'm going back to Mars. I have the money, so I will build a very large telescope." So he built a 24-inch telescope, and he put it in Flagstaff, Arizona, and he called the property Mars Hill. It's that observatory that he spent the rest of his life developing, not only the idea that Mars is inhabited, but by super intelligent beings. And that one of the difficulties is that those super intelligent beings may be so much more super intelligent than us that it is going to cause consternation. Now, the four articles from 1895 are in the Atlantic Monthly, this collection of these Atlantic Monthlies. And one of the readers of Percival Lowell's four essays on inhabited Mars was H.G. Wells. And in 1898, he published The War of the Worlds. Here's how it reads at the beginning. Book One, The Coming of the Martians. No one would have believed in the last years of the 19th century that human affairs were being watched keenly and closely by intelligences greater than man's, and yet as mortal as his own, that as men busied themselves about their affairs, they were scrutinized and studied, Perhaps almost as narrowly as a man with a microscope might scrutinize the transient creatures that which swarm and multiply in a drop of water. With infinite complacency, men went to and fro over this globe about their little affairs, serene in the assurance of their empire over matter. It is possible that the infusoria under the microscope do the same. No one gave a thought to the older worlds of space as sources of human danger, or thought of them only to dismiss the idea of life upon them as impossible or improbable. It is curious to recall some of the mental habits of those departed days. At most, terrestrial men fancied there might be other men upon Mars, perhaps inferior to themselves and ready to welcome a missionary enterprise. Yet across the gulf of space, minds that are to our minds as ours are to those of the beasts that perish, intellects vast and cool and unsympathetic, regarded this earth with envious eyes, and slowly and surely drew their plans against us. And early in the 20th century came the great disillusionment. We are replaying the War of the Worlds in an expanded interstellar version today, with the aliens, the UFOs, the takeover of human civilization. And that quality needs to be appreciated. And next week, we will go even deeper and deeper into it. I want to give you a preview by showing you the cover of a book that we talked about, published in 1853. It was begun in 1840. It was begun at the same time that The Dial was founded as the Transcendentalist magazine by Margaret Fuller and Emerson and Thoreau. The Secret Sacred Teachings of De Kuda, the last prophet of the Elk Nation, and De Kuda, an engraving was made by his writer, Walter Pidgeon. De Kuda understood that he was one of the last of the great sachem, not just the wise man of a tribe, but he was a Mahayana sachem. He was a wise man of the primordial American spiritual brilliance, because he knew how to interpret all of the different kinds of mounds that there were, many different kinds, and that these mounds were a sacred hieroglyphic, not put on paper, but put into the shaping of the earth itself, so that the surface of the earth was the record, not of symbols alone, which would make an order in the mind, but ordered the earth for its transform into reality on a cosmic level, and that the American Indian brilliance was covered up by a vast conspiracy of accusing them of being savages and in need of having missionaries set them straight so that they could be put where they're put and stay. And one of the qualities in De Kuda, right at the beginning, is the revelation, which we will take a deeper look at, that very early in the 19th century in Kentucky, a certain cave was found, and inside the cave were American Indians mummified exactly as ancient Egyptians would have mummified people some 5,000 years ago. And taking on that, the writer of the memoirs of De Kuda says, we have not understood that we may be living not in a savage land that has no civilization, but we may have received the creme de la creme of all the civilizations of the old world long ago, and they were worked into a superior civilization that was there before the old world civilizations, that kept alive the reality of where civilizations came from, not just from the Neolithic, but eventually the Neolithic is like the narrow part of the hourglass, but the full context was the Paleolithic. And that Homo sapiens sapiens originated in the Paleolithic, and that the American Indian spiritual brilliance kept and preserved the Paleolithic into the land in such a way that it was sacred enough to seem like a primordial wilderness to those who came to it for the first time from falsity outside, from the European institutionalized layers that covered up the land, that plowed the land. And the same thing was happening in America. The mounds were being plowed up so that they could be returned back to the Neolithic to be places where farm crops were going to be, and that as the forest was cleared and the ground plowed up, the primordiality of America was being effaced by an industrial plague, and that by 1853, it was easily understood that we are making a cancer out of the ecology of truth by desecrating the reality of the planet. It is hard by 2008 not to understand the implications of this. I remember 50 years ago, a good friend of mine from Waukesha, it's a suburb of Milwaukee, Bill Main, about 6'5", thin guy. He had been in the US Navy, and he had sleepwalked during the day to perform his yeoman labors, and then read philosophy like Bertrand Russell all night. He said, when you're out on the ocean, the shipping lanes even then were full of flotsam and jetsam, floating trash, and that it literally spanned the globe even 50 years ago already. We live in a falsity where the scabs and scars obliterate almost all of the healthy tissue. But the healthy tissue can be brought back not by returning to anything, but by becoming primordially real, which gives us a future and a new past kaleidoscopically. That's what this is about. And there is such a thing as a princess of Mars falling in love with a courageous Earthman and producing adventures. More next week.